from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russian separatists dismiss Putin's call to delay a referendum. Hundreds of people are feared dead after militants attack a town in Nigeria. A look at the defense building in Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
There's nothing more important and critical for any country in any region to have domestic military capabilities.
And we hear from a Harlem jazz singer and Afro-pop diva with something more. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Pro-Russian insurgents in eastern Ukraine decided today to go ahead with a referendum on autonomy, despite a call Wednesday from Russian President Vladimir Putin to delay the vote. The scene now appears set for more violence. Jamie Detmer reports from Donetsk.
In yet another twist in the weeks-long Ukraine crisis, insurgent leaders in the east of the country say although they respect Russia President Vladimir Putin's request to hold off voting on whether to secede from Ukraine, they cannot comply. Rebel leader Denis Pushilin says the insurgents understand Mr. Putin cares for the people of southeastern Ukraine. But we are the bullhorn of the people, he says, adding people in the east won't accept the government in Kiev, and that there was a unanimous decision by the insurgency leaders to go ahead with Sunday's referendum. The decision by the separatists to proceed with the vote comes as a poll by US-based Pew Research, released Thursday, found a majority of Ukrainians want the country to remain a single, unified state, with 93% in the pro-European West favouring a retention of the current borders of the country. The survey reports that 70% of those polled in the troubled East also back unity. But another insurgent leader, Mislav Rudenko, believes the vote on May the 11th will result in a vote to break from Ukraine. He says the decision to go ahead with the referendum was an expression of the people's will and shows democracy in action. Wednesday's appeal by Russian President Putin urging Moscow-backed separatists to hold off on their vote came as a surprise. The interim government in Kiev appeared divided on how to respond, with some ministers welcoming the request, saying it could create the conditions for dialogue. But others are suspicious. They accuse the Russian leader of wanting to weaken Ukraine by splitting the country into semi-autonomous parts that could more easily be manipulated and dominated by Moscow. Mr. Putin on Wednesday not only urged for a postponement of the referendum, but also called on Kiev to stop a military campaign aimed at restoring order in the east. However, top Ukraine security officials say they have no intention of halting their operations. They claim Moscow is fomenting the uprising in the region, and they are having a difficult time stemming the violence in major flashpoint towns throughout the east.
No, it's a complete illusion.
Like all the separatist leaders in the East, Valery Bolotov, the separatist leader in Luhansk, insists Moscow doesn't pull the strings when it comes to the uprising. The insurgency is an expression of the people's will, he says. Some individual Russians help with money, he says. With Sunday's vote now going ahead, Ukrainians are braced for more conflict. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
Russian President Vladimir Putin Wednesday at the Kremlin suggested publicly for the first time that Ukraine's May 25th presidential election, the target of recent Kremlin scorn, is now a move in the right direction. However, Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk dismissed Mr. Putin's comments as hot air. Mr. Putin also said Russian military units massed on the Ukraine border have pulled back from their forward positions. However, the White House, the Pentagon, and NATO all said no immediate signs of withdrawal had been detected. NATO and the Pentagon have identified at least 40,000 Russian troops and armor poised on the border in recent weeks. The troops' presence has drawn widespread criticism from Kiev and from Western governments, which see the deployment as a move to intimidate Ukraine that has heightened tensions across much of the country. For a look at the Ukrainian military power, we hear from VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnera.
Western estimates say the Ukrainian Defense Ministry controls between 70,000 to 130,000 men under arms. But Stephen Blank, an expert at the American Foreign Policy Council, says Ukraine's armed forces have enormous problems.
Their command and control at the top has been very shaky. There have been several defense ministers and heads of various forces since the new government came to power. Second, their intelligence services have been penetrated for a long time by Russians. Third, they have been undercapitalized, victimized by corruption and poor leadership for years.
Keir Giles, head of the Conflict Studies Research Center, says Ukraine has been trying to modernize its armed forces.
But it is a great deal less ambitious and less well-funded than the equivalent in Russia. So Ukraine is still operating the kinds of equipment which are no longer in service with the spearhead of the Russian forces. These are older types. They have an older manning system. Much less has changed for the Ukrainian military since the end of the Soviet Union than it has for Russia since the Georgia War.
Experts say Russia's effort to modernize its military was prompted by the poor showing in Moscow's 2008 five-day war with Georgia over two separatist regions. One reform was to make the Russian military more mobile, better geared for rapid response and for local conflicts. The result of those reforms were on display during Russia's annexation last month of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Experts say Ukraine is still tied to having a large Soviet-style army. Giles says another problem facing the Ukrainian military is the potential divided loyalty of its members.
And we shouldn't believe all of the stories that we've seen coming out of eastern Ukraine about defections, but it's still the case that many of the senior levels of the Ukrainian armed forces served together with their Russian counterparts in the Soviet armed forces, and it's still the case that many of the Ukrainian servicemen that we have encountered in the days before this crisis emerged described themselves quite openly as being Russian.
Pro-Russian separatists control about a dozen towns and cities in eastern Ukraine. In addition, an estimated 40,000 Russian troops have been deployed on the Ukrainian border, the spearhead of a potential invasion force. Keir Giles and others say the Ukrainian military is not ready to thwart a Russian invasion if it happens.
Certainly in terms of capability, the Russian armed forces are far better equipped and better organized at present than the Ukrainian equivalents. However, there are caveats to that. Now, many of the people who look at the sustainability and logistics of the Russian armed forces still believe that they are no longer in a position to fight an extended campaign, which is, of course, a risk if they overextend themselves into Ukraine. So any operation in Ukraine would have to be as quick or as unopposed as the armed conflict in Georgia or the operation in Crimea.
Experts say if Russia invades eastern Ukraine, it runs the risk of a protracted war, especially if the Ukrainians engaged in guerrilla warfare. And that, say analysts, is not a scenario favored by Moscow. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Hundreds of people are feared dead after militants attacked a town in northeastern Nigeria, setting fire to homes and businesses and shooting residents as they tried to escape. Local officials say suspected Boko Haram militants stormed the remote town of Gamburu Nangala on the border with Cameroon. News reports say more than 250 homes, the town's biggest market, and a police station were destroyed. Meanwhile, the U.S. military is providing details about a team of experts heading to Nigeria to help with the search for 276 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the team will arrive in a few days.
Their mission there is to simply assess and advise. These personnel will be experts in areas to include communications, logistics, intelligence, all of the functionalities that we believe will be helpful.
At least four countries have now agreed to help Nigeria: the U.S., the United Kingdom, France, and China. Boko Haram's leader said the group intends to sell the girls, who were taken from a school in Nigeria's Borno state on April 14th. Nigerian police have offered a $300,000 reward for information leading to the location and rescue of the students. Boko Haram is blamed for thousands of deaths since it launched an uprising against the Nigerian government in 2009. The group has attacked schools, churches, mosques, police stations, and markets while seeking to establish strict Islamic law in Muslim-majority northern Nigeria. Nigeria declared a state of emergency in three northeastern states a year ago, but efforts by the military to crush or even contain the insurgency have been unsuccessful. One terrorism expert says, despite horrific acts of brutality carried out by the Islamic group Boko Haram in Nigeria, the biggest international terrorist threat continues to emanate from the Middle East, specifically Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Greg Barton, acting director of the Center for Islam in the Modern World at Australia's Monash University, spoke with VOA's Victor Beattie about the issue. He notes there is a Jabhat al-Nusra, which operates with rebel forces in Syria, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which reportedly controls the city of Fallujah in Iraq, and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula based in Yemen. As for Boko Haram, Barton says most attacks are confined to Nigeria.
This is a group that only came into formation about a dozen years ago. It only turned violent and self-consciously became jihadi in 2009, just 5 years ago. And in part that was because of response to police brutality. There was an incident in which as many as 700 Boko Haram members died in police custody. Now, the group itself has behaved in a most barbarous fashion, and nothing we say about it can excuse its behavior. But we need to look at what drives a group like this in surviving in a society that doesn't like it. Boko Haram is very unpopular in Nigeria. It doesn't reflect traditional Nigerian understandings of Islam. No one wants them around. Their behavior is completely horrible. So how could they possibly recruit and grow? And so far, it's been partly because of inept police and military responses and often heavy-handed, overly brutal responses that leave family members responding to the death of a loved one by signing up with the group. So we should be very careful about isolating these groups in society and diminishing their power to reproduce themselves and slowly try and bring them under control in terms of their recruiting. And to do that, it's the hearts and minds piece. We need to get general society on board and protect those who are vulnerable to reprisals and protect those who are vulnerable to being preyed upon for recruiting.
You've noticed now the international response. Do you expect this to become an international fight in Nigeria?
I think the U.S. is torn between two impulses here. And the one, there's a very natural impulse, the desire to try and help. I mean, schoolgirls being taken hostage, possibly to be sold off as slaves or into marriage. You can't think of a more horrible image that should rightly evoke a response. So the U.S. And other nations naturally want to try and do something. U.S. Special Forces could do something very useful on the ground. On the other hand, there's no desire for this to be a U.S. military operation. So more in the realm of giving technical assistance, helping the Nigerian military police locate Boko Haram groups and locate their hostages, and then helping them move in a way that minimizes loss of life. The potential for this to end up like the siege of Waco is very high. And of course, Waco occurred in America, so even in the world's most advanced military power, authorities can make mistakes and make matters worse. So I think it's right that America should be involved and other nations, and I think we'll see increasing attention on Boko Haram. But we need to look at the structural issues that made it possible for this group to emerge and work with the Nigerian state to try and diminish those weaknesses in the state. And it's not simply a case of poverty, it's not simply a case of inequity, but the fact that the northeast of Nigeria has proven fairly fertile for this group to operate means that more needs to be done on local security and on addressing local grievances and providing other ways of getting young people into meaningful employment so that they're not at a loose end and prey to being recruited by such groups.
Greg Barton, acting director of the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University. A massive explosion in a tunnel dug by rebel fighters destroyed a historic hotel facing Aleppo's iconic 13th-century citadel. Both opposition and government sources in Syria are reporting numerous casualties among government troops being housed in the building. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Amateur video showed an enormous mushroom cloud rising into the sky over Syria's largest city of Aleppo after a blast leveled the Carlton Hotel, shattering windows and scattering debris for hundreds of meters. Explosives placed in a tunnel under the building destroyed the 150-year-old Ottoman structure. Dozens were killed, including many government soldiers. Government troops continue to hold the citadel and several neighborhoods inside the historic old city of Aleppo, while rebels control surrounding districts and areas north and east of the city. Rebels recently agreed to lift the siege of the nearby government-held towns of Nubal and Zohra. Government warplanes have pounded rebel districts of Aleppo with homemade barrel bombs since December, causing hundreds of casualties. Amateur video has shown entire buildings leveled in the aerial bombardment, with many residents buried under the debris. An explosion in a tunnel under a government military base earlier this week killed dozens of Syrian soldiers near the town of Marat al-Nauman in Idlib province. Opposition activists say it took rebel insurgents over 50 days to dig that tunnel. An amateur video showed rebel fighters digging one such tunnel somewhere in the north of Syria. The group of mostly young men show off their work to visitors, describing their efforts. Syrian government sources claimed recently to have destroyed a number of rebel-built tunnels in the Damascus suburb of Jubar. Once a rebel stronghold, most of Jubar has been recaptured by government forces. A rebel commander in Syria's third-largest city of Homs describes a deal with the government to exchange prisoners in parts of the country. He insists, however, that the deal is not a truce. Amateur video showed government soldiers being released Thursday as part of the deal.
ما حصل اليوم من تفاهمات أفضت إلى إطلاق سراح 70 من المخطوفين.
Homs Governor Talal Barazi explains on Syrian state TV that a third wave of rebel fighters are being allowed to leave the old city Thursday. Amateur video showed several groups of fighters being evacuated from the old city within the past 48 hours. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Bital Saab, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, has released his substantial report on military activities in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. In The Gulf Rising, Defense Industrialization in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, he finds the two nations have been steadily improving their capabilities. We asked him, what exactly does defense industrialization mean?
Well, basically, it's the effort to create what you call a local defense industry, and that essentially means any effort to produce and manufacture arms locally.
And what has Saudi Arabia and the UAE been doing about this?
Well, over the past decade, they have been quietly but steadily developing their defense industrial capabilities, and that essentially means that they have been able to manufacture, design, co-produce with international companies a bunch of military items, and that would include military vehicles, communication systems, unmanned systems, including aerial drones. They're now capable of maintaining a lot of those items. In the past, there was the old saying that Arabs simply cannot do maintenance. Basically, they would buy all sorts of weapon systems from the West and the United States, the most modern stuff, but they simply wouldn't be able to not only use them, but also maintain them. I think that over the past decade, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and those are the two countries I focus on, have upgraded significantly their capabilities in terms of maintenance, overhaul, repair, and like I said before, manufacturing.
What is their motive for doing this?
It's a great question. We don't typically know these things. They keep their cards close to their chest, but we can make several reasonable assumptions. And I list a few in my report. I think the most important one, I would say the most dominant one, would be national security. Sure, they have a great relationship with the United States, and then there's a strategic partnership between the United States and these two countries. But at the end of the day, there's nothing more important and critical for any country in any region to have domestic military capabilities, and that means that they have to rely on themselves to protect themselves and their own interests. So national security is a very dominant reason. Others I list there would include reducing their dependence, political dependence, on the United States and those outside powers that totally dominate the international defense market. So they're trying to achieve some sort of self-sufficiency in certain areas. They'll probably never get there anytime soon. A lot of countries around the world, even the most industrialized ones, will not achieve self-sufficiency, but their goal is always to reduce that dependency as much as possible.
Batal Sahab, resident senior fellow for Middle East security at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. He says another reason for the military buildup is prestige. We hope to bring you his comments on that tomorrow on our program.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
In a world that often insists on neat entertainment genres, some singer-songwriters will not be boxed in. Meet Somi, a singer-songwriter born in the Midwestern U.S. to African parents. She is both a Harlem jazz singer and an Afro-pop diva and something more. VOA's Adam Phillips has her story from New York.
When Somi plays at hip New York venues like Joe's Pub, the mood can be distinctly African and homegrown American. That's because Somi has roots in both worlds. Somi lives in Harlem, home to one of America's largest African diaspora communities and a rich heritage of jazz and African American arts. Somi was born in the U.S., spent part of her childhood in Zambia, did a post-college stint in East Africa, and later toured the continent with her band. But relatively early in her singing career, she felt somewhat misunderstood on both sides of the Atlantic.
I felt like people wanted me to be either an African artist or a jazz artist or a this artist or a that artist. And I was like, but I'm actually all of those things.
Her life changed in 2011 when she was offered a teaching fellowship in Lagos, Nigeria, a city packed with 20 million people.
I got there and the energy was difficult, was challenging, was inspiring, was hard but beautiful, was tragic but magic.
She kept a journal of her impressions and musical ideas inspired by Nigeria's huge cultural and financial capital. Her song, Ginger Me Slowly, featured on her upcoming CD, The Lagos Music Salon, dates from that time. In Nigerian slang, to ginger someone means to spice them up, to make them happy. Somi's adventure coincided with Occupy Nigeria, a highly visible grassroots movement fueled by anger over the government's cutting of fuel subsidies. A friend's housekeeper told her she could no longer afford to visit her family in the countryside on her $2 a day wage, which Somi says is the Nigerian average.
You know, she was a widow. She had kids to feed. She had to, you know, figure out how she was going to get to and from the mainland to the island and continue this job, and she was devastated.
The encounter inspired Somi to write a song called $2 Day. Some other new songs also explore difficult, even painful themes like genocide, sex work, female circumcision, and body image.
But also talk about the beauty and also talk about the magic, you know, and also talk about what might inspire both myself and the people around me.
Somi says her time in Lagos feels like a dream to her now. It's a feeling she and her audience might never have known had she not searched out the heart of her Africa and then returned to her Harlem home, deepened and renewed. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.